the Cubs and Beavers, you can when they're on wheels, you can take off on one wheel and reduce the drag on one side. And I do that sort of out of force of habit now on takeoff, just like they do on a seaplane. You pop one float out to reduce the drag.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 25 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. A quarter of a century. How did that happen? Over 24 hours now of seaplane podcast content for you all to enjoy. If you're new to the show, On The Step is all about float planes and flying boats. It's my job to find and interview people involved in our wonderful aviation niche of seaplanes, and I really hope you're loving the show. If that's the case, tell a friend, share it on social media, and review it on Apple Podcasts. To get in contact with me, as usual, my email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at thatmallardguy. Now, folks, we are going to jump straight into today's episode. For a long time now, I've been following Aussie seaplane pilot Toby Dawn on Instagram, at AeroplaneToby, without knowing anything about what the company he worked for actually did. But now, I've got a great idea, and I'm excited to share it with you. I feel like this company is a bit of an unknown in Australian seaplane operations, with a popular float plane, a, according to Toby, floating tinny flying boat, and a host of tailwheel aircraft. Blue Sky Airways are an exciting up-and-coming company I'm excited to share with you all. For now, folks, let's start our passenger briefing. Explaining the use of life jackets and emergency exits, we'll load the packs into our seaplane, start the engine, and once the oil pressure is in the green, we'll get going on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Alrighty, from Cessnock in New South Wales, I'd like to welcome Toby Dawn to On The Step, mate. How are you going?
Yeah, Dan, good, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, mate, very good, very good. Excited to have you on the line, mate, and talk all about your company, Blue Sky Airways, operating some seaplanes down in the New South Wales area, mate. Why don't you just give us a little bit of a background of your company just to start off with?
Okay, so I started with Blue Sky Airways in 2015 as the initial startup person, and then became the chief pilot once we got our CASA approvals a couple of months later. We initially operated our lake, it's a Lake Renegade for all structural intents and purposes, but Lake called it a Sea Fury just because it's a later model Renegade with more corrosion protection, and that's about the only difference from a Renegade. We started off with that and doing scenic flights, and then we added the Beaver on floats and then a Caravan on floats. We've now got a Caravan on wheels as well. And we've also got a Chieftain. We operate another Chieftain for another company as well. So we sort of branched more into the general charter scene. But we're also operating for about an 18-month period above and beyond Tasmania, which is Tasmanian seaplanes down in Hobart, which was a really good experience to work with them while they got their own CASA approval.
Yeah, absolutely. I just spoke to Henry last week on the show. Very interesting story, down there at Tassie, and yep. An airline pilot. Coming back to the GA seaplane world, very cool. Love hearing that.
That's right. You can't get enough of it.
Exactly. And mate, you're a bit the same, but you're from the engineering side. So why don't you take us back and tell us a little bit about how you got kind of into aviation?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I learned to fly while I was still at school and got a PPL when I was in year 10, and then did a little bit of private flying during year 11 and put it on hold while I finished my high school certificate. And then I went back and finished my CPL, got a command instrument rating and instructor rating, and did some casual charter work and some casual instructing for a couple of years. And then the opportunity with Jetstar came up, so I took that, and I was with Jetstar for 4 years, which as an AME, which was a really awesome experience working on A320s mostly, and a little bit on the 787s. And all the while I was still doing some casual instructing, and then when this opportunity came up to become the chief pilot for Blue Sky Airways, I took it because I really miss flying regularly, and decided that was as much as I love engineering, I love flying just as much, so I thought, oh, I'll go and have another crack at the flying side of things.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to Peter Gash as well in the last few months, and
yep.
you know, he's a guy who has a really successful land plane company in Sea Air, but also has a huge engineering background as well. Have you actually incorporated some of your engineering skills into Blue Sky Airways?
I have. So as well as being the chief pilot, I'm now the HAMC, or the head of airworthiness and aircraft maintenance control. So it definitely does help to have a bit of a sort of broader understanding of the maintenance requirements, as opposed to just having a maintenance release for an aeroplane. So it does help me with scheduling maintenance and that sort of thing, and being able to read maintenance manuals and maintenance schedules, that sort of thing. So it definitely, there is a lot of crossover there in my current role, which is really, I'm very lucky to be in such a role, because I do get sort of the best of both worlds, and because I still do have a very, very strong interest in the engineering side of things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And are you getting the tools out, or is it mainly just in the cockpit at the moment for you?
Unfortunately not. No, I do miss it, but no, my toolbox sits in my shed gathering dust most of the time now. Yeah. But I do sort of miss swinging spanners, but it's just the time is, it's just not there at the moment. But I do hope to at some stage, whenever I get a chance, get back into it. I'd love to get stuck into some sort of restoration project or something like that, which is something that's not particularly time-based as far as needing to be done in a hurry.
Yeah, there's some good seaplane restorations you could do, mate. Find some sort of old flying boat and fix one of those up or something in your spare time. That'd be good fun.
It's sort of been, that's been the goal since about age five. But as you know probably better than most, it's not a small undertaking with that amount of corrosion and that amount of sheet metal work. But it's always been sort of the dream. So I mean, what you fly is always been one of my short list of aircraft that I'd love to be involved with in some way, be it from a maintenance point of view or otherwise. So flying boats have always been sort of a fascination, which sort of morphed into seaplanes in general.
You better not talk to our engineers, mate, because they might actually talk you out of becoming an engineer on the Mallard. Sometimes it's pretty frustrating, I reckon.
I can imagine, yeah. I mean, it's in some ways, you sort of, some days you stop and shake your head, don't you, and go, well, putting an aluminium aeroplane in salt water, it's about the silliest thing we can come up with, but, you know, we do it because we love it.
Oh, absolutely, and you only have to say that, the Mallard's 7 years old, and just as long as you maintain it well, obviously it'll keep doing the job, but it's the maintenance costs and the maintenance effort that is obviously the pain. But
that's right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, our Beaver is now this year 63 years old.
Wow.
And to look at it, I flew passengers today who couldn't believe that it's a 1957 model. And I mean, I had to explain to them that it's really not the same aeroplane. It's been rebuilt that many times over, but it's still the same data plate. It's still the same aeroplane. It's been repaired that many times. So it is pretty amazing and testament to the engineering capability of people who work on these old aircraft.
Yeah. Don't they say that, if there's a plane crash, it's just the data plate that's worth all the money. Isn't that right?
That's right. I think that's the deal with, there's quite a few types around that are really sought after, even if you've got nothing but the data plate. Yeah.
As long as that data plate's intact, you're all good.
Exactly, that's right. That's the expensive bit.
Now, mate, you mentioned the Beaver there. Why don't you give us a little bit of a rundown of what you guys do with that aeroplane, and how does it involve the floats? And I know that it's on wheels at the moment. Talk to us all about what's going on.
So we actually bought that machine. Some people will remember it from being with Cairns Seaplanes. It's VHCXS, which was up in Cairns for... now I can't remember exactly how many years, but we bought it about 3 or 4 years ago on Edo 4930 straight floats, which for our intended purpose wasn't really all that applicable, needing to land it on the runway at Cessnock. So we then actually got damaged then while it was on a mooring. So then whilst it was under insurance and we were doing the swap as well, that's when we actually decided to do the restoration as well while it was all pulled apart. But we put it on Whipline 6100s, the amphib version, which adds a fair bit of, we lost about 200 kilos of usable load, but surprisingly it went a little bit faster. So, which I've since discovered, everyone reckons that Whiplines are not as great on the water, but far better in the air, which seemed to be the case with ours. And so we operated then for, must have been about 2 years or so on wheels, doing a little bit of scenic work and the occasional little bit of charter. But we've since made the decision, just because we weren't using it quite enough on floats to warrant the added insurance costs and maintenance costs and all those big costs we were just talking about, we decided to put it back on wheels. So at the moment, it's on Alaskan Bush wheels, the 35-inch Beaver Specials. That's nice. Which is that's a pretty cool name just to start with. It's called a Beaver Special. and they're a very low-pressure tyre. Obviously, if you're landing somewhere where you really need those tyres, I don't really want to be on board. They're a serious tyre. But they do absorb absolutely everything, we're now doing scenic flights in it with on wheels based out of Cessnock, and also a bit of training. So we've had quite a few inquiries with it on floats. People wanting to just not necessarily they want to look to ever fly one again, but they just like the idea of being able to put it in their logbook and say, "Hey, I've flown a Beaver." But the insurance cost of being able to do training on floats was just sort of prohibitive, so we never really seriously considered it. But now that it's on wheels, the cost is a little bit more reasonable, and we've actually now got it insured for training and got our syllabus for tailwheel training, and we're offering training in it now, which seems to be it's only recently been put back on wheels and come out of maintenance, so we haven't actually pushed the topic yet. But there's a lot of people been giving me calls saying they'd like to do some training in it, which I can well understand, really. I mean, it's a machine that just it sounds good, it looks good, doesn't go fast, but it's just one of those classics that people can say, "Hey, I've flown a Beaver, I put it in my logbook," and that's something, me personally, I love instructing, so I that's sort of been my little niche within the company, trying to push a bit of training in unique type aeroplanes, which is, you know, very lucky to be in a position to be able to do that and to have a boss who's very supportive of any avenue of business we can come up with. So I'm really excited for that and hope that comes off to be able to teach other people or give other people the opportunity like I've got to have been able to fly the Beaver.
Yeah, no, I'm certainly in that boat as well. You know, very humble to have those hours in the Beaver for sure. Yeah, what's it like, I guess, flying an aeroplane that is one day on floats and the next on wheels? Like, is it like flying two different aeroplanes completely?
It isn't. It's when I first got in it, and you're probably the same. You could get back in a Beaver after not flying one for ages and go, "Oh, this is home. This is they just feel like an aeroplane should."
Put your hand on your arm out the window and yeah.
Exactly. Days. That's right. Yeah. So you get in it and go, "Oh, this is just how an aeroplane should feel." And even compared to most tailwheel aeroplanes I've flown, it's got quite a flat stance, even on wheels, even as a tailwheel aeroplane. So you can, it's one of the few that you can actually see over the nose because of that short, stubby nose. You can actually see past it rather than a long nose of something else that's sitting pointing up at the sky. So that sort of felt quite homely as well. The only difference that did get me on the first few landings is that you're sitting about 3 feet lower. So I even now I keep having a tendency to flare a couple of feet too high and then go plop. I've beaten that out of myself now. But yeah, the first few landings were just that little bit different. It felt the exact same aeroplane, which I think that's what made it harder in a way, because it feels like it did on floats, except for the fact I've got to remember to fly it 3 feet lower before I flare.
Yeah.
Now I've got the hang of it and got where the cowl sits in relation to the horizon and that sort of thing. It's quite fine. It's probably the most docile tailwheel aeroplane I've ever flown, actually. Maybe a Cub is slightly more docile, but even compared to something like a 185, it's so docile compared to something like that. It's even leading in a bit of a crosswind, it doesn't really have a tendency to do anything silly. And it's really quite a pleasure to fly on wheels. It sort of takes all the good bits of the Beaver as far as that high lift wing with the flaps, and I mean ours has got wing fences with one of the gross weight upgrades, and it takes all that, but then removes the significant drag of the floats being on it, and it turns it into a real performer, actually, which was quite surprising. I mean, between max takeoff weight and empty weight, we've got over a ton. With an hour or so of fuel, you've got a payload of nearly a ton, which is pretty impressive out of a piston single.
Absolutely.
But I absolutely love the type. I've loved them for years and years. And I mean, I always wanted to fly on floats, which I got to do, and fly it quite a bit on floats, which I was really lucky to do. And then I've always thought, though, that they do look really good on wheels, and I didn't really ever expect to get to fly on wheels, to be quite honest. But then it happened, and I thought, oh, wow, they sort of fly as good as they look. There's an old saying in aircraft engineering that if it looks good, it'll fly good. And I think that's pretty true with the Beaver. It looks slow, it looks docile, and that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Mate, you've actually got a few other tailwheel aircraft in the fleet as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about those as well?
Yeah, we do. So we've got the Piper Cub, which we do a little bit of tailwheel training in. It's on par with docility with the Beaver. It's even slower again, so if that were possible. So it's really good fun. It's got big tyres, not quite as big as the Beaver, but it's on Alaskan bush wheels as well, so it goes pretty well anywhere. We also offer training in the Cessna 185, which is again on bush wheels. It's definitely a better performer than a Beaver, or well and truly better than a Cub. But with the Continental 520 in it, so it really gets up and moves and has the performance after takeoff. But then we also offer scenic flights in the Tiger Moth as well, which was actually the first tailwheel aeroplane I flew with a fellow named Phil Unicum, who was the 1991 World Tiger Moth Aerobatic Champion, if I've got the year right.
There's a stat.
There's a stat. Yep. And he's a bit of a legend of aerobatics and aviation in general. But so that was really good to get to fly with him. And we now still both work at the same airport, which is kind of cool.
There's a bit of a aerobatic kind of industry out at Cessnock, isn't it?
There is, yeah. So there's as well as the flying school, which the grade one instructor there, Anthony Moore, was the fella who taught me to fly Chieftain. It's Phil's school, there's Paul Bennett Air Shows, and then just across over at Lake Macquarie, which is a couple of minutes flight away, we've got Matt Hall Racing there doing the same thing, aerobatic joy flights. So there is quite a – it's actually a really cool little area with sort of all this enthusiast-type aviation as well as just the general flying training. But there is also like a strong contingent of, aerobatic stuff, warbird stuff. I think just by sheer accident, all ended up in the same sort of area, which is actually really, really cool.
No, it is a cool area, mate. Like I said, we were there in Rathmines last year for the Rathmines Festival, the Catalina Festival there.
Yep.
And obviously, the home of the Seaplane Pilots Association of Australia is down there at Rathmines as well. So, you're right. A real bush flying little area around northern New South Wales and the Newcastle area for sure.
It is, that's right, yeah. And, I mean, we've even got John Daly, who flies the Catalina for Haas.
Oh, yeah.
So he was a fellow who flew it when it had the engine issue at Rathmines a couple of years ago. So he hangs out at Luskin Tyre as well. He's got a Cub. I actually did his Cub check out. So that was quite an honour to get to fly with John, because he's a legend of aviation as well.
I'll have to get him on the show.
You will. He's got many a good story, and he's a very interesting fella and flown just about everything. But we're really lucky for sort of young, and I'm now 30, but I still consider myself young and up and coming and trying to make my way in aviation.
Mate, I'm 30 as well, mate. I'm still young too. Come on.
Yeah, there we go. We're both young. And for people like us that are sort of still making our way through aviation, I think it's a really handy area to be, actually, with so much experience around the place and so many good personalities to interact with. I'm really quite lucky to fly where I do.
Yeah, absolutely. And mate, you've also got a little flying boat in your kit there of aeroplanes that you seem to have. Tell us a little bit about that one.
We do, yeah. So it's a Lake LA 250, which is essentially it's identical to a Renegade. The only difference, as far as I can tell, is supposedly superior corrosion protection, which is always a positive with a seaplane. But it was actually the first aircraft my boss owned, it's still sort of his pet. But we're now operating it as it's on our AOC for charter, and we're operating it as Newcastle Seaplanes out of Newcastle Harbour, which is a really exciting venture we've got going as a scenic flight, operation scenic flight, picnic flights to beaches in the Lake Macquarie area, that sort of thing. So I'm really excited for that, actually, because we hadn't done an awful lot with it last sort of year or two. So it's kind of really exciting for me, actually, to be the first aeroplane that we had and had on our AOC. It's sort of exciting to be back flying it again and doing some commercial work with it. But we also offer that under our 141 approval for instructing and to do the floating hull endorsement, which again I think is I've sort of always had this idea for many years. I'd love to operate a school where, not the mainstream sort of school, where, because I know and I work with quite a few instructors and a couple of schools who do a very good job of doing the mainstream instructing, getting people a private license or a commercial license. And I thought that's sort of not what I want to branch out into, a bit of a niche and allow people to fly unique things that they otherwise or elsewhere might not ever get to fly. The Lake Renegade or the Lake Sea Fury sort of tied in quite well with that. And it's it's different to being flying the Beaver or the Caravan on floats, which is you're sitting up above the water. The flying boat, you're actually sitting down in the water. I'm assuming you and the Mallard are sitting still a little bit higher, but in the Renegade, you're basically down in the water, which is really cool, actually. It's for all intents and purposes, it's a tinny with wings. And it is great fun. It's a lovely machine. It makes an absolute racket in the circuit. It's with a Lycoming 540, and the propeller with the tips are bent over.
Oh, right. And, okay.
And it does. I will agree with the neighbours. It does make a racket.
Yep.
But it's actually a really fun machine to fly. So we bought, or my boss bought it off John Davies, who's a renowned name in seaplanes. So that was my first seaplane endorsement or seaplane type, was with John in the Lake Sea Fury. And I still fly with John occasionally for some currencies, refresher flying and that sort of thing. So it's sort of good how small the industry is, really, and everyone knows everyone and still sort of everyone keeps in touch, that sort of thing. So it's got a bit of a soft spot for me, that aeroplane, just because it was the first one on our AOC, and I actually did my very first chief pilot approval in it. So it was it is good to have it back online doing a little bit of work.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, the seaplane industry is a small one. It's a very close-knit community, and I'd like to get John on the show down the track if he's interested one day. And that's what I love about this podcast, is kind of sharing those stories within our industry all around the world. So
it's great.
It's very cool, mate. And you mentioned the chief pilot check there. Tell us a little about what it's like to do a chief pilot checkout on a seaplane.
Well, the first one I did was in the Lake Sea Fury, which is a floating hull aeroplane, but that was actually for land planes only. However, I said to Cass, well, this is the only one we've got available. I said, well, they discussed it and said, well, we don't actually need to use the design feature. So it's basically the same as a commercial pilot's license flight test, really. There's a briefing session the day before on the flight route and that sort of thing, as far as what's going to be expected of you. And then you get the flight route and plan the flight like you would for a CPL flight. And then you take the CASA examiner on the flight. You get a diversion or two, an engine failure, and do some stalls, some steep turns, all the usual stuff, really. And it was the first one. It was scary, just because in my own
CASA
mind it was scary.
Next year.
Because it's CASA, and what do I do? I've always actually had a really, really positive experience with CASA, and it's been really good since then, actually. So since then, moved on to, we added Chieftains and IFR to our AOC, and then the next one I did was adding floats as a design feature. So that was, I did that in the Beaver. That's actually a fairly hard one as far as getting it booked in with CASA, simply because there's not many flying operations inspectors around now that have the appropriate endorsements to be able to do it. So I ended up doing that in the Beaver. We went for a flight from Cessnock over to Lake Macquarie. We basically did a mock scenic flight or a mock charter over to the lake, landed on the lake, and it was the same deal as a commercial pilot's license test, in that the examiner or the testing officer is not there to fail you as such. They're just there to make sure that if they weren't there, then nothing untoward would have happened. So it's been a really good experience, actually. I mean, the fear, and I'll put that in inverted commas, the fear of flying with CASA sort of makes you really be on top of your game, just because you don't want to turn up and forget something or say the wrong thing, that sort of thing. So I think it's been a really good experience for me, not because it was scary, just because I had in my mind it was going to be scary. So that means it sort of made me study and just stay a little bit more on top of my game than I probably otherwise would have been.
I think it must be all the instructors that have real, bad experiences with CASA, because it seems like everyone who leaves flight school just thinks CASA's out there to get you, doesn't it? So.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's just because it's instilled from a very early part of the career from, disgruntled older flying instructors, or I'm not sure where that all comes from. But yeah, I have noticed that as well. And to be honest, it's sort of the wrong attitude to have, really. But
it is, because, a lot of those CASA guys are super experienced GA and airline pilots.
Right.
So they've got a wealth of knowledge. And, mate, I also did a chief pilot check when I was in the Whitsundays. And, I spent 2 days with a guy and, did basically the same what you said, just a scenic flight in the caravan.
Yep.
I think we did a ramping at Hayman and took him to Whitehaven and then like a forced landing into Hamilton Island and then back to shoot. It was just a little triangle around the Whitsundays, but it was a great learning experience. And they're out there to help you improve as well. So
exactly, that's right. Yeah, and I mean now I'm sure at the time it wasn't relaxing for you, but looking back, you go, well, that sounds a nice day out, doesn't it? Ramping at Hayman and going to Hemo, and looking back, it's all quite positive, actually, and it's making me look back on my checks now with them, and it's all actually been a very positive experience, to be honest.
So what's your dealings with them now as chief pilot? Like, how often would you actually get to go and talk to CASA, or do they come through regularly to help you with other things?
Yeah, so we get an audit yearly, is sort of a smaller one, which is just a desktop one, and then every 2 to 3 years you'll get a bit bigger one, as far as there's different levels of audit depending on, and you've got to have a big one once every 3 years. But we're sort of regularly adding things to our AOC and adding different approvals, that sort of thing. So I'm in contact with CASA fairly regularly, actually, and we've got a designated flying operations inspector who's attached to our AOC and looks after our AOC and then reports back to the team leader for the Sydney area. And so I would say I probably ask CASA a question at least once a fortnight. So it's fairly regular contact, really. I've always found that if I'm not 100% sure of a rule or how I'm allowed to do something or whether I can do something, it's easy just to ask, and then you at least know yes or no. And if it's no, I go, oh, well, I'll give up thinking about that. Or if it's a yes, they can at least tell me what the actual ruling is as to what I can do. And it's they put it to me when I first became a chief pilot that they're there as a resource, so to use them. And I've sort of taken that on board, really, and I do. So regularly I'll give them a call or an email and say, hey, am I allowed to do this? Or what do I have to do to apply for this? And they're always very helpful. So it's always been a positive experience for me.
Yeah, that's very good, mate. You've got a lot of aeroplanes there, and you keep adding things to the AOC there. So there must be a few pilots helping you out. How many guys have you got there with you, if any? And
at the moment, we've only got the four, other than me, and one of whom is my second in command. He sort of does a lot of the helps me with a lot of the CASA type stuff, and then we've also got the guys who fly the vintage stuff. They're very experienced, and they come in really handy with their wealth of experience and aviation experience. So and then we've also used another pilot casually as well, who we share with another company. So that sort of works in for us as well. We like to work in with other companies, but at the moment there's five of us all up on the AOC in various different capacities. But because it is, as you say, we've got a sort of a fairly varied fleet, so it's it is hard to find pilots who are trained on everything.
Yeah.
So that's why we've sort of got some different areas of expertise there, be it tailwheel expertise or instructing expertise or that IFR expertise, that sort of thing. So it's actually, for me, it's a really fun mix, but that's where it is handy to have the pilots that I do at the moment, and who really help me out by having all their wealth of knowledge to be able to bring to the table.
And what about seaplane flying? Are you the only guy doing the float stuff?
At the moment, I am, yeah. So we had Henry, who you were talking to earlier, on our AOC, and a couple of his pilots as well, back when we were looking after OHD there, Beaver down there, which so that was handy for me as well, to have some the extra experience of the guys on board to be able to ask their opinion on things. But yeah, as of at the moment, I'm the only seaplane pilot, just because we've only got the Lake Renegade at the moment as far as an operating seaplane. So once if that ever changes and we start really doing some more seaplane stuff, then yeah, that'll have to change. We will have to either train someone up or get someone on board to do some more seaplane flying for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I bet the guys are jumping at the bit to get into one of those seaplanes and have a fly.
It's the sort of thing that not many people ever get the opportunity to fly. So so everyone, as soon as the concept of flying a seaplane comes up, a lot of people are very excited, and that's where a lot of extra experience, as far as it's a lot of hands-on flying, so that's where the tail wheel experience and that sort of thing definitely does help in the general handling of a seaplane. So that's where the varied experience of the pilots under our AOC definitely comes in handy.
Yeah, I've spoken to guys about that before as well, just the whole tail wheel float plane thing where they kind of mix a little bit, you know, with the way that things handle. How have you found that crossover of tail wheel versus float plane?
There's a lot of similarity as far as the stuff you can do with a tail wheel aeroplane, which is not to say you can't do it with a tricycle undercarriage aeroplane either, but generally the types of aeroplanes that you fly with tail wheel undercarriage are more akin to a bush type plane or a utility type plane. So for example, the Cubs and Beavers, when they're on wheels, you can take off on one wheel and reduce the drag on one side, and I do that sort of out of force of habit now on takeoff, just like I do on a seaplane. You pop one float out to reduce the drag, and it's far less necessary on a land plane, just because you don't have near as much drag. But
those bush wheels are pretty bloody big, though.
Well, that's true. Yeah, so I still find out of force of habit, though. I start rolling in. I'd always lift the left float, so I always start rolling in right aileron on takeoff and lifting the left wheel, and I find that I take off with when the whole aeroplane gets airborne, I find that the left wheel's already about an inch or two above the right one, just out of sheer habit. But that general feel of the aircraft definitely is a quite a crossover between seaplanes and bush type flying and all that what you call utility type flying. It's much more of a feel type thing than compared to IFR flying, which is a lot of watching gauges and trusting instruments and that sort of thing. There's a lot more with seaplanes and tail wheel aeroplanes, just looking out the front and watching where's the nose going, because inevitably wherever the nose goes, the rest of the aeroplane's going to follow along shortly thereafter.
Yeah, that's generally how it works, isn't it?
That's right. Yes.
Mate, you know, big things have been happening around the world with coronavirus and everything. How has your business been affected, and how much flying are you kind of still doing at the moment?
It's changed. We're still doing quite a bit as far as company-wide, but it's changed what we're doing. So previous to that, we were getting a lot of inquiries for scenic flights, that sort of thing, like leisure-type stuff, be it vintage flights or just general scenic flights and that sort of thing. Obviously, that all stopped when the restrictions started, and it's actually the last week or two, inquiries have started coming back in. We've started booking the occasional or little bits of scenic type stuff and joy flights. But during the shutdown, it was actually weird. It was quite a worry for us during the early days, going, well, what's going to happen? And to be fair, that's the worry everyone's had, because no one really knew. But we got right into it, and then because the airlines were shutting down, we actually found the charter side of things was still happening. Not the same type of charters as we were previously doing, where a group of people might go away for a weekend or that sort of thing. But as far as essential stuff that just couldn't get anywhere, or essential personnel that couldn't go on an airliner because they simply weren't operating, or on very reduced schedules, we actually picked up quite a bit of work out of that as far as general charter. And for the stuff that still had to go regardless of the shutdowns, so it was for our business personally, It wasn't as bad as we thought it could have been, and I sort of feel very almost guilty saying that, because I know a lot of companies were really hit hard and still are being hit hard, but we were quite fortunate to still at least be able to do enough work to justify business.
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a positive. I mean, like I said, I've heard some terrible stories about a lot of aviation companies, not just float plane companies, but, you know, helicopters, other fixed wing operators, you know, just completely dropped down to zero, you know, especially in those tourism areas like up the top here, you know, over in Broome, in Kununurra, you know, places like that are really struggling. So, no, it's a great thing that you've been able to keep operating through these tough times and, you know, keep you guys employed and keep moving people around, like you said.
That's right. And I think we're just lucky in that we didn't do one or the other. We didn't do just scenics or just tourism stuff, so we're at least lucky that we could still at least do the general charter and the freight charter, that sort of thing. So that's that side avenue to our business is really what's been keeping us flying lately.
Very cool, mate. That's good to hear. Before we get down to the end of the interview, mate, have you got any ripper stories about flying seaplanes that you've bottled up for a long time, just waiting for a podcast to come out and tell?
There's got to be
a great seaplane story that you've had down there on the coast somewhere.
There's definitely some good ones.
any you could share on a podcast?
Any I could share on a podcast? No, there's nothing nothing drastic as far as nothing that I shouldn't say. I'm just not sure where to start. I mean, there's always the ones where, you know, fairly, I'm sure you're guilty as such of it as well. You know, you're trying to shift an aeroplane around on the water and not get wet, and you end up falling in and do get wet.
I'm lucky
enough that I haven't lost a phone. Have you? You lost a phone?
I have, actually. Yeah, it was down in Geelong. Right. It was actually, mate, it was a funny story, that one, actually, for me. We were in a little cradle with the 206 I operated with my old man, and the cradle had two kind of walkways that basically were parallel the float. That was where it kind of sat in. And as you went to push it out backwards, the wind caught it, and I was holding onto a rope to the float there. And, natural instinct, you're just trying to fight it by yourself. You're trying to hold on to this aeroplane. And like literally at my foot, there was a bollard. I could have just quickly wrapped this thing around it. And I just kept holding on and it pulled me straight in. I had an old Nokia N95 or something like that, mobile phone, the old slide phone. And she got a bit drowned. But
That seems to be a common thing. But I actually personally haven't lost a phone yet.
That's a good, good job.
One day we did have the Beaver moored when it was on the Edo 4930s. I had it moored at a mate's place over in Lake Macquarie, which is a really lovely spot. And that was previous to it going into maintenance. So I was basically caretakering it there. So I'd be going down to it fairly regularly and pumping the floats and running it, that sort of thing. So I took my mum along one day. And it was a bit of a choppy old day, and it was actually sitting out on the mooring. So, my mate had a boat that turned out to be a children's toy boat, and I was rowing out with my mum out to in the probably about a foot of swell out to the Beaver, and then of course so we've tried to get alongside the Beaver, and mum's reached over for the Beaver as I've lost touch with it and drifted away from it. So in mum went straight to the bottom. So that's a memorable one for her and for my mate as well. That was a couple of years ago, but he since brought it up recently. So that was quite entertaining.
Yeah.
It's another time. What was I doing? I can't remember what I was doing. I was doing something on the floats, and then I was standing on the front of the floats, and sure enough, stood up and cracked my head straight into the prop.
That one was
quite a painful one, actually. That was a good few days of quite a headache, so I didn't fly for a couple of days after that. But I don't think I'm the first or last person to do that either.
No, my old man told me he was flying over in Broome there, just on wheeled caravans. He must have been doing a part of a daily or something, and knocked his head on the prop.
Yep.
And I think he walked back inside, and you know how much the head bleeds compared to anywhere else.
Exactly.
He said it looked like a crime scene walking through the office at Broome Aviation or wherever he was. There was just blood everywhere, you know.
It makes for an entertaining spectacle for onlookers anyway, that's for sure. It's, there's nothing soft about an aeroplane propeller, that's for sure.
No, there certainly isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably – probably the personalities I come across too in I suppose it's not just a seaplane world thing, but in aviation in general, there are some, like we discussed briefly earlier, the personalities in the Hunter Valley alone. But yeah, everywhere you go, there's someone with a good story, and sometimes you don't even care if the story's true or not. You're certain it's got better every time it's told, but who cares? I think it's that's what puts the fun into aviation, isn't it? Sometimes it's the personalities you come across flying around the countryside.
Yep, absolutely. There's a lot of characters in aviation, that's for sure.
That's right.
Mate, we might as well jump into the final part of the interview here, which
yep.
I like to call the splash and dash questionnaire. So just like the land plane touch and go, the seaplane splash and dash. We'll touch through a few quick seaplane related questions.
Okay.
Mate, yep. What has been your favourite seaplane that you've flown so far?
Have to be the Beaver. I didn't even have to pause for that. The Beaver just not as easy as the Caravan, with the Caravan having reverse and that sort of thing. Definitely makes it a more user-friendly aeroplane, but just the sheer elegance, I think, of the type and the sound. So yeah, definitely have to be the Beaver.
That's pretty good. One of my favourites too, for sure.
Yep.
What's you've flown bush planes really as well. What's a seaplane been one of your favourite planes that you've flown, or does that kind of title go to a land plane?
To be honest, the Beaver wins either way. I thought that the Beaver on floats was the greatest plane ever. Till I flew a Beaver on wheels, and then went, I think this tops it. So it's still a seaplane. It's still that same utilitarian type machine, but it's just taken all the good bits and made it even better, I think, being on wheels. So yeah, the Beaver wins regardless whether you're talking seaplane or land plane.
Fair enough. Good answer. You've got a lake, a river, some open ocean, or maybe a Coral Cay up in Cairns there. What's been your favourite place or best place to land a seaplane so far?
It depends from the point of view of scenery. Definitely the sort of the estuarine areas of like Lake Macquarie, which is a saltwater lake. And so you've got all the good bits of, you've got the really lovely water, you've got the beaches, but you've also got a protected area to land. That's definitely a positive. But I think as far as from the pilot point of view, of sheer enjoyment, I think landing on rivers, especially if they've got a little bit of a curve in them. And to be honest, I haven't done a lot of that, but it's when you do it, I think that's just, it's really cool when you've got this narrow body of water that you're following. And, that's what really does it for me.
Yeah. I mean, I've been through Lake Macquarie, as I mentioned, through the Rathmines Festival, and what an incredible lake that is. That's one of the coolest places I've actually landed a seaplane, I reckon, with just houses lining the edge of the lake basically everywhere you go, and then having the ocean right basically just outside of the lake.
That's right, yeah. And you're basically on Lake Macquarie, you've got, which is the purpose of the Catalina base originally, was you've got about 10 kilometres of runway. So it's, and in every direction. So it's actually a really, really cool spot for seaplanes. And even the ramp that's purpose built, which is that little bit flatter and not quite as steep as a boat ramp, it's actually a little bit nicer to get up with a seaplane. So which is exactly what it was built for. So it's something that I think should be preserved for good. And it's good that there are plenty of like-minded individuals around who are looking after it, because it's something that should be protected for good.
Yeah, no, it's a cool spot. Yeah, that ramp is certainly one of the shallowest ramps I've ever seen.
Yep.
Compared to the one of the Whitsundays where you're almost, falling down the back of the aeroplane as you go up the ramp. Certainly not much change in incline on this one.
Yes, yeah, I've heard of that ramp that you're talking about up in the Whitsundays, but I've never actually witnessed it myself. So it's one day I'll have to go and experience it for myself, I think, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, especially in the Caravan, the wingspan, you're almost clipping trees there as you go up. And then parking out the back is a little parking area out the back there that you can get into with, little buggies driving around as well.
Yep.
It's insane.
One
of my favourite ramps was actually in Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
In Ha Long Bay, operating up there, which was basically it was actually the barge ramp. So you could fit two barges side by side on this ramp.
Oh, wow.
So it was quite wide. Probably not as steep as the Whitsundays one, but it still had a good incline on it.
Yep.
But the thing was, because it was a barge ramp, it was just basically, and it was a ferry as well, so you could drive your car on there and it'd take you over to a different island and stuff. So kind of a barge ferry, I guess you should say.
Yep.
But it was basically a road as well. So the amount of times we drove that seaplane, the caravan, up onto the top there, and just having hundreds of motorbikes, you know, like Vietnam's, just everywhere, you know.
That sounds like a serious adventure.
Yeah, it was. So, you know, you need 50 ground crew just to keep everyone away.
Yeah,
you know,
I can imagine. So never any mishaps, never any close calls there?
No, not really. I mean, like I said, there's a lot of ground crew to keep everyone at bay, and it drew a lot of interest every time it started up, and you know, there'd be onlookers from everywhere, and people would pull up on their bikes pretty close and everything. But I think generally common sense does prevail in these situations, and people still, even in countries like Vietnam, where they don't see these kind of aeroplanes on a daily basis, they still choose to kind of just stay back a little bit, which is good.
The common sense mentality of keep clear of the spinny thing sometimes still applies.
Yep, even I think the caveman would probably stay away from this thing, I think.
That's right, yep. Oh, that's cool.
Mate, what about a dream seaplane to fly? Have you ever thought about one certain plane that would... You'd kind of drop everything to go out there and have a burn in.
It's now admittedly it's a long shot. It's but the short Sunderland. That's growing up, I used to spend hours and hours reading about it and finding any bit of information I could reading about the short Sunderland. Just the double deck. It's just huge. I've actually been to the Royal Air Force Museum in Hendon and seen one in real life there. And of course, there is one that's supposedly, in theory, still airworthy with Kermit Weeks over at Fantasy of Flight in Florida. But although as much as it's physically airworthy, it hasn't actually flown for many years. So I don't expect ever to get to fly one. But it's that's always been the number one. If I could get to fly a Sunderland, I reckon that would be really cool.
That's on top of my list as well, I reckon. Those boats that used to go out to Lord Howe out of Sydney there, and just incredible, you know, four engine radial, doesn't get much better than that.
No,
double decker
right.
as well, like you said, you know.
It's got all the good bits to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Great answer, that one. What about dream seaplane job? Anything around the world that you've spotted, other than working for Blue Sky Airways, of course, that, you know, really stands out as what you think could be the dream seaplane job?
I think a lot of the operators that fly over in Canada, into which a lot of it's into freshwater lakes, I reckon that'd be really cool. Some really nice scenery. You know, you see the color of the water, it changes depending on the season, and it's just that the place they go, the remoteness, I think is part of the attraction as well. Which is, I suppose, the whole intent of what a Beaver was originally intended for, was to be able to get to hard to get to spots. But I think somewhere like that would be really cool to do for, you know, even if only I do it for a season at some stage. I think it's got to happen eventually, although obviously with current world circumstances, not likely to happen soon. But I think one day it'd be cool even to go over and do a bit of casual work, take some leave, and just for the experience, that'd be a really good thing to do, I think.
Do you ever see yourself getting back on the tools at any stage, and kind of stepping away from flying?
I don't think so, to be honest. It's always a backup trade if ever I was to lose my medical or something like that. And I do still love the mechanical work. But as far as on a day-to-day basis, I think I just love what I do at the moment too much to want to do anything else, really. So I still got that that little bit of mix of the engineering stuff, but more from a paperwork point of view than a hands-on point of view these days. But at least it still keeps my interest going with the maintenance side of things. But, to be honest, I don't think so, really.
And mate, finally, I'd like to finish the chat with, have you got any advice for any aspiring seaplane pilots out there, anyone who wants to get into the industry to fly floats or even bush planes? What kind of advice would you give to those people?
It's, as you know, it's a very niche industry, so that's where it's hard to get your foot in. So I think it's something that you've got to, if that's what you really want to do, you've really got to push it from the start. So when you're doing your flying training, even decide during your CPL training what you want to do. As far as if you only want to fly seaplanes, then you can start, you know, talking to the right companies and getting in the know a bit early rather than finishing your CPL and with an instrument rating or an instructor rating or something, and then try and decide how you get involved. So I think you've got to really push it from the start, just because it is such a niche industry and there's so few operators around. But that's not to say it won't happen. As long as you're in the right spot and really push it, you can definitely make it happen. But there's things that might help you more so than others as far as ratings, endorsements, that sort of thing during your training. So that's where it's probably easy to decide early, which you'll know if you. I think, as you probably know, if you want to be that sort of pilot, I think you already know from the start whether you want to be that sort of pilot or some other avenue of aviation. So it's something that I think you've really got to push hard for just because of the smallness of the industry in Australia.
Good advice, mate. Well, Toby, Dawn, it's been great having you on the step, mate. You can really tell that the seaplane and bush pilot blood is flowing strong through those veins, mate. So, really appreciate you taking the time off to come and talk all about your company, Blue Sky Airways.
Yeah, no, thanks a lot, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. It's been great chatting to you.
Cheers, Toby. All the best.
Thanks, Dan. Likewise.
And that's the show for today, folks. Really appreciate Toby taking the time to speak with me about Blue Sky Airways and for calling that Lake Seafury a flying tinny. That one will stay with me for a long time. Make sure you check him out on Instagram, folks, at AeroplaneToby, a great seaplane and bushplane page with some great flying content. Episode 26 is coming shortly, folks, and I'm not going to give away anything this time. It's a surprise. So, until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.